Ammon Shea is a word nerd. He was a furniture mover for a long time, but the budding writer spent his free time reading, and much of it, reading dictionaries. One day he decided to take an entire year, 8 hours a day, to pore over 20 volumes. That would be the entire Oxford English Dictionary, which he did in a basement library in Manhattan. Ammon Shea joined us from New York, and we asked him why.
What really attracted me to it is that, like many people who love to read, I have this feeling of kind of incipient sadness when I'm coming to the end of a book and I realize that soon I will no longer have this book to read. And so I figured if I was reading a book that was almost 22,000 pages long, that that feeling would take significantly longer to come around.
In a way, that sounds like hard work.
Well, it sounds like a kind of monastic, you know, deprived existence, perhaps. But I have to say it was absolutely delightful. And it was such a moving experience. It felt so similar to reading a great work of literature.
As in, the words would open up as prose and poetry to you?
Now, that's part of it. Part of it is coming across all these wonderful words that are kind of hidden in the depths of the English vocabulary that we don't come across.
For instance?
For instance, a word like perachme, P-E-R-A-C-M-E, which describes the point in your life after you've passed your prime. It's a kind of sad little word. And one of the things that's interesting I find about coming across these forgotten words is that when they describe something, that I then think of that thing more often. For instance, there's a beautiful word, which is a petrichor, which describes that kind of warm, loamy smell that comes off of the pavement when it first rains. It's a beautiful smell. I've always loved that smell when it first starts raining. And now I don't talk about that word so much, but I do think about it when I come across that particular kind of gentle smell wafting off the ground.
Huh. You have among the words you picked, miss-kissing.
Yeah. Well, that's something else that I really kind of enjoy. So many of the definitions are kind of old, and so they're in a way open to interpretation, and miskissing is more or less defined as kissing that is wrong. And that could be really interpreted so many different ways.
But did it say
I don't think they really
could be against the morals of the community, or it could be just you hit the person on the cheek, or you just weren't that good at it.
No, in this case, they didn't specify, I believe, which of the possible varieties of improper kissing they were talking about.
There's a great old-fashioned word that I think really should be revived: be dinner.
Yeah, to treat somebody to dinner.
It's a verb, right?
Yeah.
He bedinnered her.
Yeah. I mean, I love the fact that be dinner means to treat somebody to dinner, and be missionary means to pester or annoy somebody with missionaries. One simple prefix is good for so many things.
And then there is a very wonderful long word. It starts with pneumonia.
Oh. Pneumona ultramicroscopic silico-volcanoconiosis.
Which is?
It's not a terribly exciting word. It is the longest word, I believe, in the OED. It's a kind of lung disease, which I think typically minors are afflicted with. And these great big imposing-looking words, they're relatively easy to define. And I was contrasting that word with, for instance, the word set, which is three little letters, but the definition is about the length of a short novel.
Huh. Now, I'm jumping ahead in the dictionary, but you got to the uns, U-Ns.
Un was probably one of the roughest sections that I came across. There's about 450 pages of entries that begin with U-N. There is no definition. There are typically not citations. They just say this is a self-explanatory word. However, every once in a while, inside those terribly boring sections, there would be words like unlove, which is the action of ceasing to love a person. So every time I became tempted to just say, skip ahead another 100 or 200 pages and just pretend that I read all of this, I would come across one of these great words.
Now, if you'd skipped ahead through all those uns, you would have hit vocabularian.
Somebody who pays too much attention to words. I have been accused of that.
I really splurged a few years ago, a while back, and bought the OED on a CD-ROM. And did you ever think in terms of just doing this all on the computer?
Well, Oxford University Press has done a really magnificent job of putting the Oxford English Dictionary online. However, when I sat down at one point and I did try to read through online straight through, I just felt physically ill. A large part of the appeal of this entire project was just that I love reading. The tactile sensation of turning one page to the next and feeling my fingers across them. I love having the weight of the book in my lap. I like the way the books smell. That's a huge part of it. In fact, the first thing I do with a new book generally that I get, whether it's an old book or a new book, is I like to open up and take a good sniff of the pages. These are all, to me, sensations that you can get from a book that you can't get from a computer.
What was the moment like when you finished reading the last page of the dictionary, and the last word would have been?
Zyxt, Z-Y-X-T. It's the second person singular indicative present form of the verb to see in a kind of archaic English dialect. But when I did finally finish reading that, I had a brief feeling of euphoria. You know, I danced a little jig in the library basement. And then shortly thereafter, I realized I had to go back and read the bibliography.
Ammon Shea is the author of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages. And if you're a bit of a vocabularian yourself, you'll find a list of some of Shea's favorite words and an excerpt from his book at npr.org. This morning, as the Summer Olympics get underway in Beijing, we go back to a different time and a different Olympics. Our story is about a young Jewish athlete from Los Angeles who was torn over whether he should play on the first U.S. Olympic basketball team. The year was 1936. The games were being held in Hitler's Germany. And the athlete was Sam Balter, grandfather of NPR reporter Carrie Kahn, who brings us this recollection.
Looking back, I guess I never really knew the details of my grandfather's journey to the 1936 Olympics. I swear I remember being told stories of him marching before Hitler and showing off his gold medal in a display of Jewish pride. But my grandfather's stories always had a way of getting bigger the more he told them.
He always made a story better. He always made his role better. But I don't think he lied.
That's my mom, Barbara Kahn. She got the full story of my grandfather, her dad, when he was in his late 70s. He talked, she recorded.
He was happy to do that.
You had to get him to stop.
Yeah, okay.
How did you get him to stop?
I'd say that we're done for the day, and I turn off the tape recorder.
This is March 9th, 1986, and we're going to talk about the selection process for the Olympics and the Olympic Games.
Over the hiss of the old cassette tapes, my grandfather can still command an audience. Patu, as we called him, projects in his professorial tones.
I wouldn't pretend that I was one of the seven best basketball players in America, but the method of selection at that time somehow placed me on the team.
Patu was an unlikely pick. Well under 6 feet tall and by his own admission more clever than fast. But basketball was still a young game. Patu played in Southern California on a team sponsored by Universal Pictures. They made it to the Olympic qualifying round where the final match was played in Madison Square Garden. As he told it, the crowd was on its feet as Universal Pictures beat their longtime rivals, the Oilers of McPherson, Kansas. The score was 44-43.
And a reporter came up to me and singled me out. Couldn't figure out that was. I played the whole game, but I wasn't the big star. And he asked me if I was going to go to the Olympics. I laughed. I says, why, of course, why not? He says, well, you know, they're being held in Hitler's Germany. Big silence. I just never had given it a moment's thought.
He quickly asked the reporter to strike his cavalier response and then spent 3 months agonizing over what to do. As a Jew, there were many groups urging him to take a stand against Hitler's Germany and boycott the games.
I was told by others it was absolutely imperative that I play on the team. I had earned the honor, and more important than that, what kind of propaganda tool would we have if we are played in Germany and there were no Jews in the American team?
The American Olympic Committee president, Avery Brundage, assured the athletes that the games would be free of Nazi propaganda. Apparently, that gave my grandfather the opening to pursue his once-in-a-lifetime chance to be an Olympian with a clear conscience.
Up goes the official flag on the liner Manhattan, carrying 334 athletes.
In July of 1936, he boarded that ship from New York to Germany.
Time to shove off. And America's biggest Olympic team in history is on its way. May good luck ride with them.
But it wasn't long before Patu said he was worried he had made a mistake. In spite of the promise that Hitler wouldn't use the games for his Nazi cause, my grandfather says there was no shortage of anti-Semitic propaganda.
You could buy it on any street corner, and I have a copy of it now. Haven't you seen it? It's in one of my scrapbooks. It has caricatures of hook-nosed people.
So while you were there, you were getting a picture of it.
I saw that. But I didn't see it as bad as, obviously, as bad as it became later on.
Politics aside, he remembers the thrill of meeting the founder of modern basketball, James Naismith. And he complained that the Germans didn't really understand basketball. They scheduled all the competitions on outdoor dirt courts. The final game, U.S. versus Canada, was played in a torrential rainstorm.
If you dribbled, it was a splash and the ball floated away.
At halftime, the score was an unremarkable 15-4.
And these two teams, supposedly consisting of the best players in the world, each scored 4 points. 4 points each in the entire second half.
The Americans won the gold 19-8. But what my grandfather left out is that he didn't play in that last game. The U.S. team actually consisted of 2 7-man squads. It was the other team that played and won, not his.
It wasn't our turn. It was the turn of the other group. And we didn't get medals until much later in the match. So we had a lot of beefs.
An inauspicious end.
Yeah.
I never heard that story until I listened to my mom's tapes. Patu never marched in front of Hitler or got his gold medal on a podium in front of the world. It was mailed to his home months later in Los Angeles. His win was barely a footnote to the achievements of the legendary American runner Jesse Owens. But my mother says being part of the 1936 Olympics was the achievement of his life.
I believe that probably is true because everything in his career flowed from the fact that he had gone to the Olympics.
It helped launch his career as a successful Los Angeles sportscaster on radio and later on the new medium of television. He also wound up acting in several movies, always playing the sportscaster, as he did in The Champion, starring Kirk Douglas.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, as you probably guessed, was the champion entering the stadium. Just about everyone in this vast arena is on his feet.
As he spoke to my mother, Patu defended his decision to go to Berlin, despite all the pressure he received as a young Jewish American.
It's the dream of all sportsmen to make an Olympic team. You can do anything else in the world, but when they write your epitaph in the newspaper, or write your obit, it's going to say an Olympic Games gold medal winner. I guess I was smart enough to know all that at the time.
Okay, let's stop there.
Okay, bye.
My grandfather died 11 years after making these recordings. He was 88. And he was right about his obituary. In the first paragraph, the LA Times remembered him as a gold medal Olympian. During his life, my grandfather filled 24 scrapbooks, mostly with newspaper clippings about himself. So I cut out that LA Times obit for him, covered it in plastic, and at his funeral, I slipped it into his coffin. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
See Sam Balter in action plus a team photo at NPR.org.
You may be asking why airlines don't just raise their fares instead of coming up with all those fees. NPR's Wade Goodwin has been asking that, too.
When you fly these days, it certainly doesn't seem like the airline industry is on the verge of collapse. Go to Terminal C at DFW Airport, and the place is packed on a Thursday afternoon.
Welcome to American Airlines Flight 1788, nonstop service to Raleigh-Durham. At this time, they're still cleaning our main cabin, but they are ready for the first class cabin. Rows 3 through 6, you're welcome to board.
The plane's full. The problem is the majority of these passengers are actually costing American Airlines money to fly them to North Carolina.
I don't think we've ever seen the kind of financial stress put on the industry, and I'm including the time after 9/11.
Dan Garten is the executive vice president in charge of marketing at American Airlines. The airline industry used to be a pretty glamorous place to work. These days, it's a marathon in the Mojave. One day, this last June, the price of oil shot up $11 a barrel in about an hour and a half.
For us, it's $80 million per dollar of oil increase. So that day, our costs went up by $880 million. And, you know, in some of Americans' old good years, our total profit would be $880 million. Now, we haven't had that kind of year for a long time.
Imagine being VP in charge of revenue and discovering one afternoon that you're going to need to bring in an extra $1 billion or so to break even. How'd your day go, darling? So here's the question. Why don't the airlines simply raise their airfares so that when an airplane full of paying passengers touches down on the runway, they've made money on the trip?
No, we can raise fares. But if we simply raise fares regardless of what our competitors do, then we find ourselves in a situation of being non-competitive, and I can virtually guarantee you the revenue result for us will be negative.
Here's the thing. The vast majority of Americans' competitors are in the same boat. Only Southwest Airlines is eking out a profit because of advantageous fuel hedges. The other airlines, United, Delta, Continental, US Air, the list goes on, all need to raise fares or they'll go bankrupt. It's as simple as that. Now, federal law prohibits the airline CEOs from colluding to set prices, but the logic and the math are inescapable. Airfares have to go up. So why not go ahead already and stop the bleeding? Dan Garten says they're worried all these full airplanes wouldn't be so full anymore.
It's a laboratory. I can tell you what happens to business demand. I can tell you what happens to leisure demand.
A decade of inexpensive oil and the internet have created this trap for the airlines. Dave Castlevetter with the Air Transport Association also partly blames you, the flying public. When you bring up a travel site on your laptop and click on the button that says list flights by lowest fare, you've done your part to bankrupt some poor foundering carrier.
You click the button that says the best price, the computer will give you just that, the schedule that has the best price. If one carrier's price is a dollar more, that carrier's schedules will not be seen by the customer.
You can see the problem. Airline executives would like to make a profit, but they're busy trying to stay on the first page of the search results. And that's why they've started charging to check luggage, to sit in an aisle seat, etc. Those ancillary fees don't affect your position on the page on Travelocity and Expedia's merciless list of flights by lowest fare. Here's another question. How much would the airlines have to raise their fares in order to make a profit? About 25%. So if a passenger is currently paying, say, $400 for a round-trip ticket, the industry needs that to go up to about $500 round-trip. That will be the discount fare. American Vice President Dan Garten says they're going to bring customers around to this unhappy reality slowly, or at least as slowly as they can, given the fact that they're losing $300 million every quarter.
We actually need them to understand the issues and to sort of accept it and in some ways help us. We need our customers to understand how important American Airlines is to them, air travel is to them, and that, you know, whether it's $15 for your first bag or whatever fee it is, you know, it's not really the big issue. The big issue is, am I going to be able to fly to Los Angeles?
So here's their plan. Over the next several months, the carriers are going to cut capacity and then raise fares. Then when the travel website tells you that it's going to cost $1,800 to take the family to see grandma and you angrily decide the airlines can go jump, those seats you would have occupied aren't there anymore anyway. But the airlines would like you to remember that Grandma misses you terribly, and a phone call is just not the same. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
If you're flying soon, you can put even more pressure on those troubled airlines. Just go to npr.org to learn ways to find cheaper airfares.
It's peak tomato season, which means it's the busiest, sweatiest, most back-breaking time of the year for Tim Stark, a self-described accidental tomato farmer.
One large heirloom. And the Wild Max?
No, Sweet Chelsea.
Oh, yeah, they're nice.
That's Tim Stark at the Union Square Green Market in Manhattan this week. He trucked in a ton and a half of tomatoes from his farm in Pennsylvania, 100 varieties, mostly non-hybrid heirloom tomatoes, all organically grown.
Two red beefsteaks, one Sweet Chelsea.
Tim Stark started out in 1996 on a whim, growing several thousand tomato plants from seed in his fourth-floor walk-up in Brooklyn. Now, 12 years later, he farms 12 acres in Pennsylvania, where he grew up. And his tomatoes are sliced and diced and stacked on dinner plates of the finest restaurants in New York.
Seven for John George, seven mixed cherries. Seven
a tomato farmer. It's not what Tim Stark imagined for his career. He started out as a management consultant and would-be writer until tomatoes took over his life. Tomatoes with wonderful names, as he describes in this reading from his new book, Heirloom.
Cherokee Purple, Green Zebra, Garden Peach, Plum Lemon, Radiator Charlie's Mortgage Lifter. I could not help noticing how these tomatoes responded to me in ways that women, bosses, and literary editors never had.
The cover of his book shows a gorgeous assortment of tomatoes, orange and red and purple, green and striped, all blemish-free. But some of his tomatoes are as homely as they come.
Yeah, they are. They are. They're, in fact, I guess some of the companies are marketing them as ugly tomatoes, they call them. But sometimes it's just the uglier the better. And some of them are just incredible how they – there's one called the peach tomato that really prefers to look like a peach. And there's one that prefers to look like a pear. There's even some that look like bell peppers. They're really varied. It's pretty amazing. I actually find the ugly ones, they tend to split and crack and get beaten up a lot more. And those are the ones I always eat. And I always say they're the best.
Why do you think it's better?
Yeah, it's sort of like the, I don't know, maybe the ugly duckling story or something like that. It shows character, the cracks and the rips, the bruises. And if it's perfect, that means maybe it's been pampered too much and it doesn't have character.
You have a great line in your book talking about, you know, those perfect, shiny, fancy tomatoes at the supermarket. And you say, to fall for them is a bit like talking dirty on the telephone for $3.99 a minute.
Yeah, I did say that, didn't I?
You
did.
Oh,
my goodness. Yeah, you pay all this money and they look great. They look fabulous, but it's not the real thing.
How did it happen that this operation that you started sort of on a whim in a way, you know, now you are providing tomatoes to the fanciest restaurants around New York, and everybody seems to know exactly who you are.
Yeah, I always say that first year we had an incredible crop of, say, 60 varieties of tomatoes. And at that time, nobody was growing that kind of a variety. I mean, at Union Square, nobody had 50 varieties. There were people with growing Brandywines and Cherokee Purples. So it really caught the eye of a lot of restaurants and a lot of customers in that first year. I was really lucky. If we'd had a dry year like this year and that first year because I had no irrigation, I wouldn't be here. I'd be back in Brooklyn thinking of my next scheme.
You know, as your business took off and you started selling to all these fancy restaurants around New York, you describe delivering to them. And I guess there are times when you don't go in the back, you walk right through the restaurant and you're sweaty and grubby and you're hauling in these cartons of tomatoes.
Yeah.
I love picturing that.
And I said that too in the early years. I got thrown out of restaurants trying to do that. And I, you know, if I was delivering in the evening and I was picking all morning, I was probably a little rough. I was sort of, you know, look, I just want to get this delivered. I don't want to beg permission to go around the back. So I was probably just pushing in too. But now I'll walk right through some dining rooms during the busy time. And I think the restaurants like to have their customers seeing, you know, the farmer come through.
But you're saying now people value that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Oh, yeah. Well, you have to. I mean, if you want to be a restaurant that counts, you got to have some filthy farmer walking in with something just picked. You know, you got to have that. That's part of the look, you know.
Well, Tim Stark, it's great talking to you, and enjoy the rest of tomato season.
Thank you.
Tim Stark's book is Heirloom, Notes from an Accidental Tomato Farmer. You can read an excerpt at npr.org where he writes about his first frenetic season in the world of tomato farming.
On this formal opening day at the Beijing Olympics, at least for a few hours, talk of pollution and political dissent will give way to a highly produced spectacle. It's at the National Stadium, nicknamed the Bird's Nest. One of the highlights is the traditional parade of nations when the athletes march in led by their country's flag bearers. That moment will be particularly meaningful for the middle distance runner chosen to carry the U.S. flag. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Sometimes it's hard to cut through the Olympic hype, the TV coverage with swelling music and stirring stories, to find what games organizers like to call a true Olympic moment, one that embodies hardship and triumph and humanity all through the prism of sport. It appears the Beijing Olympics have found that moment in Lopez Lamong. The 23-year-old native of Sudan, now a citizen of the U.S., was chosen by his teammates to carry the flag. Today, he struggled to describe what the moment will mean.
I'm looking forward for tonight and go out there and, you know, represent my country and raise that flag and just proudly. I don't have any word for it. I'm just so happy, very happy.
Here's why. 17 years ago, when he was 6, Lopez Lamong was kidnapped by rebels looking for child soldiers to fight in Sudan's civil war. Lamong's captors, he says, fed the children millet mixed with sand.
The more you eat the food, you know, will not digest in your stomach and automatically will kill you. So there is a lot of kids dying, like, every day.
Three friends, Lamong calls them angels, told him not to eat a lot of the food. Then, one night, they grabbed 6-year-old Lamong and escaped. They ran for 3 days. With no idea of where they were, Lamong says they took great care to position themselves at the end of each day.
When we are sleeping, we have to sleep facing where we need to go, you know, the next day, because we didn't want to go, like, maybe around the circles and maybe go where the soldiers are.
Finally, they made it to Kenya. Lamong was taken to a refugee camp in northern Kenya, where he spent the next 10 years, often eating one meal a day. In 2000, the first of two critical events that propelled him to a startling new life. One day, he walked 5 miles with friends to watch a broadcast of the Sydney Olympics. He saw U.S. track star Michael Johnson win a gold medal. Lamong said to himself, I want to be as fast as that guy, and I want to wear that same uniform. In 2001, he was chosen for relocation to the United States through the help of a relief organization. Bob and Barbara Rogers of Tully, New York, became the foster parents of now 16-year-old Lopez Lamong.
My parents took a lot of time and, you know, to really teach me again, like, you know, little kid, and how to take a shower with the cold water and the hot water, and how to put in the middle. That is, you know.
He learned how to shower, how to speak English, and how to be a good runner, becoming an NCAA track champion. On July 6th of last year, he became a U.S. citizen. On July 6th of this year, he made the U.S. Olympic team. Now he'll compete in China, a country that supports the Sudanese government, which is blamed for the civil war that uprooted thousands of so-called lost boys of Sudan, like Lopez Lamong. At today's press conference, Lamong, a member of the athletes' activist group called Team Darfur, avoided criticizing the host country. He chose instead to tell his story, including how he reunited last year with his original family in Sudan and how they went to the grave his parents had dug for him and dug it back up.
You know, I went out there in December and we did all those things and I'm alive again.
Tom Goldman, NPR News, Beijing.
In Sweden, saving on gas is no longer just a good idea. It's the law. Sweden is under pressure to meet tough new European Union regulations on climate change. Like other European countries, Sweden is looking at alternative fuels and new technology to meet that challenge. It's also turning to social engineering to change fuel consumption. A new law requires fuel-efficient eco-driving to be part of the test to get a driver's license. Here's reporter Allison Hawks.
At Axelsen's driving school in the old industrial town of Västerås, students are scribbling away at practice tests and waiting for their instructors. Gabriella Nordan is a blonde-haired 21-year-old practicing for her state driving test. She says she's already mastered the basics of eco-driving.
It's easier than you think. the teachers explain it and you just practice it.
New drivers have to master eco-driving in both the written exam and the driving test itself. Saving on fuel consumption is now on par with stopping at red lights and merging into traffic. Officials say the techniques can save 10 to 20% of fuel consumption. Swedes may have a reputation for being very green, but their love of large-engined Volvos and Saabs means most Swedish drivers get very poor fuel efficiency.
Okay.
Nordon's instructor is Jenny Axelson. She takes Nordon to a white sedan parked on a tree-lined street and gives her her instructions. Then she locks a device onto the dashboard that tracks fuel consumption.
When the pig is coming on the display, then we're saving money and saving fuel.
Nordon barely leaves the parking spot when Axelson offers her first correction about backing out when she could have gone forward.
But here, wait. Now we will teach you some eco-driving. When you are going backwards, then you spend fuel two times. Here you can spend one time by going on the first gear a little bit and then to the second.
A lot of the techniques are common sense, and Axelson says they apply equally to stick shifts and automatics. Avoid idling, don't spend too much time in the least efficient first gear, get up to a higher gear as soon as possible. But Axelson says the real key to good fuel economy is coasting, avoiding a dead stop as much as possible by lifting off the gas pedal when you see a potential stop ahead.
When you can see that it's a red light, then it's better to go off the gas, then you can save some fuel.
Eco-driving is at least a decade old in Sweden, as are dizzying gas prices. Axelson's driving school was one of the first to offer the training when companies started sending their employees to the school as a way to cut fuel costs. Now the school is exporting its know-how. This summer, Jenny Axelson's older brother, Michael, went to Los Angeles to train 70 employees of Southern California's largest gas and electric supplier.
What I noticed when I was in California is that a lot of trucking companies, small trucking companies, are having huge problem with their economy due to the fuel price. And the reduction of 10 or 15% might help to save the company for them if they can save up money by saving fuel. So the more expensive the fuel is, the more important the knowledge like eco-driving actually is.
By next year, eco-driving will also be required for truck, bus, and motorcycle licenses. Axelson says anything with an engine is fair game for eco-driving. For NPR News, I'm Allison Hawks in Västerås, Sweden.